So, hey, ranters.
Do you want to explain why you're out of breath?
Because I was working on content for our Patreon page.
And what part of that involved you doing push-ups before we got on the mics here?
I was working up the energy to record this promo. How's that?
No. Let's try this. We are on Patreon, and you should be too. It's very simple. We have bonus content exclusive to our Patreon backers, including fully produced new episodes, watch-alongs, where we do running commentary during a Netflix streaming movie, and personalized fan requests.
And a big thanks to our first three Patreon supporters, Stacey Daigle, Betty Toxic, and Dave Allen from Dave Inside Do a Podcast.
It's supposed to be acting, Darren, but you are out of breath. You're a method actor.
I was going to say, check out Dave Inside Do a Podcast. They're broadcasting out of the Isle of Man and Run Corn, respectively. They cover horror and sci-fi from the 90s, mostly.
So thanks, everybody. And join us out at patreon.com/rantsmacabre.
It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
You are licking me.
What?
He was licking me!
Lunch Hour Reviews.
This man ate till he burst.
So he did die by eating.
Lunch Hour Reviews.
I'm tainting meat.
Tainting meat!
It's feeding time.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are the Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
All right, so we're diving back in to Ryan Murphy's American Horror Story series. This time up, we're doing season 4, Freak Show.
Yes.
And I guess just as an upfront sort of, not disclaimer exactly, but based on the material, we're going to be using vocabulary specific to the industry and sort of circus sideshows and freak shows. And, yeah, well, down the line, they refer to them as monsters. We probably won't do that.
No, probably not.
So we're going to ask you for the benefit of the doubt in terms of our best intentions and that we are trying to cover this material with as much respect as possible.
Right.
It goes pretty deep in terms of history, and it was probably only in the last 30 years that people started giving a shit about treating these
people
with respect as human beings and, you know, sort of trying not to hurt their feelings.
Right.
Even in the IMDb breakdowns of the movie Freaks, they still refer to the little people as midgets.
Right. And which we all know now is like a no-no.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, it's hard and we will do our best. There's our disclaimer, I guess.
Okay, so as to give a little bit of context for the show Freak Show, which was clearly like a labor of love for Ryan Murphy. This was the first time that he came back to direct since the first season, really.
Right.
So I think it speaks to his sort of appreciation for the history of sideshows and the sort of circus culture. But we're going to be talking specifically about the movie Freaks from 1932, the Todd Browning feature.
We didn't lie to you, folks. We told you we had living, breathing monstrosities. You laughed at them, shuddered at them. And yet, but for the accident of birth, you might be even as they are. They did not ask to be brought into the world, but into the world they came.
And that's probably the first time the Sideshow Collective had been featured in a film. And I caught up to this movie very late. I kind of knew its historical background, and I'm fascinated that Todd Browning went from Dracula, at the time probably the biggest film in the world, to this passion project. Todd Browning coming from like a carny background, like he was a dancer.
Exactly.
He almost literally like ran away to join the circus. And so he was coming from a position of like empathy and understanding.
And even though I think it's really important to look at Todd Browning, his works collectively as well, because what Todd Browning loves kind of more than anyone else, and you really see it in his works with Lon Chaney, is revenge-driven disability drama.
Oh, that's very specific. Okay.
Yeah, but it's true, because you think of things like Miracle Man, The Penalty, Hunchback. These are, at this particular time, before Freaks comes out, this is a solitary person with a disability, either with a disability or pretending to have a disability.
Mm.
And it's always a person who, was quote unquote normal or not disabled,
an outsider,
then
sort
becoming
of...
disabled, and that has, and it drives this revenge driven
okay.
drama. And I think that's really important because it's not like Freaks comes out of the blue for Todd Browning. Mm. It's not that we haven't kind of seen this before, but this is the first time we see a group of people collectively exacting this revenge on quote unquote normal or able bodied people.
Okay. Interesting. And so I guess we talked about it a little bit earlier that the movie, its sort of inception was this short story, Spurs,
yes.
which was brought to him.
Which I love, which was brought to him by actually the little person Freaks.
Hermann, he's Hermann. German.
Yes, exactly. And he's the one who brings this to Todd Browning, this short story by Todd Robbins called Spurs. But I liked the story. You didn't think it was awesome, but I thought it was a great story.
As unique and interesting as the movie Freaks is, I thought the short story was like so much more bizarre.
I liked that, though. It was very...
I could see that.
Yeah, it was totally like this weird, bizarre thing where the final punishment is that the little person rides on the shoulders of his wife, and she's forced now to carry him across France on foot.
And it's like, it's a penalty. It's not exactly. It's not like, I need to get around, like, we're going hiking, no. just me on your shoulders.
No, it was she's a penalty now for... like an animal to him. And to me, I don't know, there was something about that revenge in that final part of the story that I think I thought it was so bizarre and exciting. And when I told you the first time, I was like kind of annoyed that you didn't like it.
It took me a long time to even just understand how they arrived at that ending.
I just think it's so bizarre. It's one of those things where I think I could be put in a room and I could write for 1,000 years and I would never come up with that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I love that.
So the movie Freaks plays a big part in the sort of influence to Freak Show. And we'll get around to Freak Show in a minute, but just to give you a synopsis of the 1932 feature Freaks. Cleopatra, a circus trapeze artist, takes an interest in Hans, a little person who works in the circus sideshow. Her interest, however, is in the money Hans will be inheriting. Meanwhile, she's carrying on an affair with Hercules, the circus strongman. Hans's fiancée does her best to convince him that he is being used, but to no avail. Mm-mm. At their wedding party, a drunken Cleopatra tells the sideshow freaks just what she thinks of them. When Cleopatra and Hercules' plot is revealed, the freaks dish out their own justice and decide to make her one of their own.
Their code is a law unto themselves. Offend one, and you offend them all.
So I thought the movie, taking place in the context of the greater circus, mm-hmm. gives us a full spectrum of relationships. We've got performers like the aforementioned trapeze artist or the strongman, and we've got clowns like Froso, who's kind of our good guy, and Venus, a blonde woman who I'm unclear what her job at the circus is.
I don't know sometimes what some of the people, I'm confused on why they're there.
She might ride a horse. Like, she might be
part
of that.
Oh, she could be a bareback, because
yeah.
that's what, in the story, Spurs, she's a bareback rider.
Okay.
Bareback horse rider. I'll be specific.
But so we get the relationship of the, I'm going to start using the word freaks, among themselves, and then even their relationship to the other workers.
Right.
And the other workers, not really explained, but there's resentment mm-hmm. towards the freaks, that they're all sort of, like, these other guys look down on them, which is ironic because in the movie there's actually two little people
right.
who are with, like, thick Irish accents talking shit about the freaks.
Yes, yes.
And so that kind of gives us a greater context. In the Freak Show season 4, where it's far more isolated. It is exclusively a sideshow on the road mm-hmm. rather than the circus as a bigger backdrop.
Right.
So I caught up with this movie, frankly, last night. I had seen bits and pieces of us, and there were, you know, there's certainly taglines that
right.
that everybody knows. But a part of me definitely watched the movie like spectacle. And
yes.
I was kind of, again, like, I'm fascinated with the idea that this movie got made. Like, Todd Browning pretty much could have made anything, and he chose to make a very personal story.
What's kind of interesting to think is how much got cut and is lost of this film.
Oh, yeah.
Because there was a lot more filmed, a lot of really interesting disturbingly graphic mutilation in some of the final scenes. And that was cut, that was left out. And this was 1932. This was a pre-code film.
Mm.
But clearly paved the pathway of people who wanted to instill these codes on film.
Okay.
They would refer to this film to say, we can't have this. It was a box office failure.
Yeah,
it
kind of
failed overseas
career.
In Germany, where they kind of liked kind of this weirder stuff over there. It failed everywhere. And this was a very strange film that you were surprised that the industry ever let Todd Browning make another one.
In terms of the cut footage, it is telling that this film is about 61 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
So it, you know, a feature film usually comes in closer to 90. And this was chopped to death. I'm going to reference a point in a minute that is like a scene that I would have liked to see the whole of, where the living torso, or Rardion, played by Prince Randian, in other freak shows he might be referred to as like the Snake Man because he has no arms and no legs.
Uh-huh.
And he kind of gets by crawling on his chest. And there's a gratuitous scene that, in terms of the story, it's gratuitous, but we watch him light his own cigarette.
Roll the cigarette and light it.
Well, that's the thing. The rolling of the cigarette is cut. Could you imagine a person in his position only able to use his lips in terms of dexterity, taking out tobacco, applying it to a rolling paper, and then rolling that, and then getting the cigarette? Like, you must really need a cigarette. Like, he gets the matches out last, and only the matches portion is what's on camera. But I would have liked to have seen the whole thing, because it's kind of it's a major accomplishment.
It's amazing. People with all hands, fingers, everything, like, quote-unquote normal, still have a hard time rolling a cigarette. So,
I couldn't, yeah.
Oh, no. Fall out both ends. Get out of here. No, that would have been amazing. And what I kind of think is interesting about Freaks in particular is, for the time, 1932, I felt that it was handled actually rather delicately and respectfully. I mean, clearly there's things that are not respectful, but for 1932, I was very surprised.
Yeah, I think the broader story arc, I don't think speaks great of these characters, and I think it's telling that a lot of the actors, the sideshow characters, were dissatisfied with the movie when it came out. They didn't feel like they were represented very well. Todd Browning, I mean, there's conflict there because, you know, Todd Browning, like we said, he was one of them.
Right.
And so I think the personal moments absolutely speak to these people's day to day, but the greater story might demonize them a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I think I hate to keep coming back to normal, but I don't know what else to say, the quote-unquote
standard
normal. Yeah, person. Those people, I think, are the worst, though, because they show to be such liars and connivers, and they're willing to murder and stuff. So they're the bad guys.
Yeah, Cleopatra and Hercules have the same contempt for the freaks as, like, the, you know, the other guy, the workers who were talking shit about them early in the movie. And I think if they did consider themselves part of that family, then, like, you don't deal against your family.
Right.
There's kind of a point to the unity. And so they, feeling like they were outsiders, their position was only one of, like, predator that they were left with. And so that's, yeah. I mean, yeah, you're supposed to feel bad for the freaks in that position that they are being taken advantage of.
Right.
We'll make her one of us. A loving cop. A loving cop. We accept her one of us. We accept her one of us.
Gooba gobble. Gooba gobble.
The movie introduces the sideshow dynamic that'll also play in Ryan Murphy's Freak Show, where the freaks are afforded, in the film, they're afforded a pretty good living in the circus, all for the willingness to be a public spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who otherwise would be remanded to hospitals if they were lucky, or otherwise hidden away as some family's shame. But because they are together, the freaks as a collective family, they live together in this world without judgment. In the circus, they choose when they'll be seen by the public, and they're doing it from a stage above the crowd. And I think that's a really important dynamic. They're looking down on the crowd just as a singer or an actor would.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to question the morality of exploiting these people. Frankly, I think it's obvious that they are being exploited, but that's never the end of the story. I think it's what makes these explorations especially interesting.
Yeah, I have many thoughts, and I also, though, understand that I come from a place of privilege where this wouldn't be something that I could ever put myself in somebody's shoes that's right. in this situation. I don't have a problem with, let's say, the living torso. I don't particularly have a problem with someone like, let's say, Grady Stiles Jr., which would be like Lobster Boy, okay. who had the mental wherewithal to be able to be in control of the situation. I kind of feel uncomfortable in certain places like the pinheads.
Yeah.
Because they don't know sometimes any better.
Right.
And that makes me
couldn't really take care of themselves on account of not being able to make the best decisions for themselves.
Exactly. Or someone like Cuckoo the Bird Girl, again, is not fully functioning at an adult level. Mm. And so that's where it becomes a little like, this is exploitative.
Yeah. And we'll see the pinheads come up in Freak Show. Mm-hmm. And they are kind of treated as children. And, you know, they're very often like given utility. They are given tasks to do around the show. Also, as a non sequitur, worth checking out is the X-Files episode that has Mulder and Scully investigating at a traveling freak show. The episode's called Humbug, and it's got a lot of like authentic workers, and that I don't know, it's one of my favorite episodes.
Yeah,
I think
before sitting down, if you haven't watched American Horror Story Freak Show yet, before sitting down and watching it, you would do yourself a solid to check out that X-Files episode, check out Freaks, check out the Violet and Daisy Hilton sisters story. Like, check out some of these things.
Yeah, you went on a spree after,
the year of 2014, I went on this crazy documentary extravaganza and started looking and learning about these people. And it is fascinating, which is what it's meant to, but I shouldn't be so fascinated. I know it's, like, wrong, but at the same time, I'm just very fascinated by the way society viewed these people and still does.
It's furthering your understanding. There's nothing to be embarrassed about or ashamed about.
I guess. So once you've done a little bit of homework and familiarized yourself, then you should start American Horror Story Freak Show. Overall, not my favorite season.
Yeah.
Not my least favorite, though.
I like the first half of the season a lot.
Yes.
Yeah. But okay, so let's dive in. I mentioned that Ryan Murphy directed the first episode of this mm-hmm. season, and it's the first time he's directed since the series pilot. The opening credits to Freak Show are my favorite.
Yeah.
I talked about liking Hotel that season, but this is fascinating. The opening credits, it's like a stop-motion nightmare, a sort of ballet of broken misfit toys.
Yes,
it's
absolutely.
The stop motion beauty. It's gorgeous.
It's based a lot in real pictures. What Barnum and Bailey had, the P.T. Barnum show at that time had these postcards.
Okay.
And the three-legged woman is a direct photograph or card. And it could have been made, you know how they were doing this spiritual making shit up in photos, but I don't know particularly
spiritualism
about
spiritualism in that
case. I don't know particularly about the three-legged woman, but I've seen the image, and it's a direct image from this old postcard, which is very fascinating.
Yeah. A quick description of the first episode of this fourth season. In Jupiter, Florida, in 1951, Elsa Mars rents a farmer's field and sets up the tents for her circus freak show. She's always on the lookout for new acts and visits the Tatler sisters, Bette and Dot, who are hospitalized after the local milkman finds their mother dead on the kitchen floor. The sisters are perfect for Elsa's show. They are Siamese twins with two heads sharing one body. Elsa sees them as her new headliners, no pun intended. Other acts include Ethel Darling, the bearded lady, and her son Jimmy, the lobster boy. The group is clearly not welcome in the community, and few people are coming to the nightly show. Meanwhile, a clown by the name of Twisty is killing people. He has also taken a young boy and a young woman prisoner. Side note, the little kid that he kidnaps is Sam from The Walking Dead.
No way! way.
The pain in the ass, like, yeah, can't take care of himself, Sam.
Yeah, I hated Sam.
Yeah, in this case, he's just a hostage. He's not much of a character.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't even think about it. I didn't even think about that.
No, I recognized him, and I looked at him. Yeah, I happen to be right. But yeah, so Sarah Paulson is the big opening reveal, and they kind of treat it with such, like, delicate suggestion that the final exposure of her above the neck is pretty shocking in that first image. And I will say the special effect is consistently great. They kind of, they use it sparingly. More often than not, you get Sarah Paulson one head at a time. And, you know, it's due to, like, the Dutch angle. They're having to film her and sort of put her in the corner. But every time she is on camera, it is a flawless effect where it's
great
natural.
Too. She's great. She really tells you know instantly which one you're looking at when the camera shoots to just one face.
Yeah,
you
that
know
is,
which
that's
sister
true.
You're looking at. And it's excellent. When I first saw it on TV, all I could think was the terrible effects in the old Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, we've come such a long way.
Paper mache head stuck to someone's shoulder.
We've come such a long way. Sarah Paulson, I mean, she's so great. And I talked the last American Horror Story.
Yeah, Hotel.
Hotel, about how great she is. But in this, it is. You can tell instantly which one you're looking at.
In terms of acting challenges, it's fascinating when an actor has to play their twin. It happens a ton, though.
Yeah.
But imagine not just playing your own twin, but like 4 inches away.
Yeah.
And so that's not just every line you're delivering, but every line you're reacting to the person. And so, I mean, levels of difficulty, this is like a 10 for 10 in terms of accomplishment. Really, really cool.
And she's always holding her head off to the side for the one sister in particular. One sister is always straight up and down, one's off to the
side. Yeah.
And that's to show this particular dominance of their relationship. But I thought, when she's acting that, like, oh my God, her neck had to have hurt so bad.
Yeah.
If you can imagine just filming and doing take after take. I think, I don't know, I love those particular characters. Just for the reveal at that beginning.
Yeah.
Dear Diary, it was the glorious 3rd of September when I was finally freed from the shadows. The future had never seemed brighter.
Yeah, and they do the very old-fashioned, I doubt these things ever actually existed, but these sort of movable X-ray panel.
Yeah.
That it's a great-looking effect. And yeah, when they're looking over the body and they're like, she has, I think it's only the kidneys that she has 3 of. Everything else, I think, is shared.
They share, yeah.
Yeah. So she's got this singular biology, but 2 distinct personalities up top.
Yeah. That is actually based on a couple different things.
Okay.
But in Freaks, you met Violet and Daisy Hilton. They were the conjoined.
Attached at the hip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Conjoined twins that were in Freaks. And Bette and Dot are loosely based on that. There's a documentary about them called Bound by Flesh, which is a really great documentary. It explores how they were sold into this life, sold from one person to another person, well, more like inherited, terrible life, ended up dying penniless. And one of the most tragic things of all, they died about 4 days apart from each other.
That was, when you said that, like, even now my hair is standing on end. Mm-hmm. That's really jarring that you're physically attached to a dead person.
Yeah.
For
days.
4 days.
Yeah.
Do you know how long they lived?
I do not know how long they lived. I know they lived into the 1960s.
Oh, really?
So they were relatively old. They couldn't actually make any more money because there were particular problems. And if you watch the documentary, you'll see there were some personality issues there. And they were very difficult to work with. But you can't understand how they grew up, and you can't put yourself in their shoes to see, like, well, they're difficult because of the following things. I don't know. They ended up, like, working in a grocery store in a small town, and that's how they lived out their life.
Wow.
Bette and Dot are also based on the Salon sisters, which more physically would probably be based on them, which were one body and 2 heads on particularly one body.
Okay. Well, these days there's a sort of corollary to reality television and the sort of their 2 sisters. I think they might be in Texas or Oklahoma, but I've seen them do the sort of circuit of talk shows.
Yeah, and I think they had a reality show at one point in time where they went to college.
Yeah, I think one of them's a singer as well. Yeah, it's kind of, the framing becomes really important because, I mean, there's not a big difference between, you know, a 1951 freak show on the road, like in the show, and a reality television that just chases these people around with cameras.
Yeah.
To, like, make a big thing out of every day in, day out occurrence.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
What do you want?
You.
To save you. Oh. To save you, save you.
So I mentioned the killer clown in the freak show season, and he's probably the second most jarring visual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people already have predispositions to, like, have nervous reactions to clowns. There's a funny picture in my, like, family's history of little Puerto Rican me pulling away from a clown crying. Like, this, it's a young girl. She's just, you know, painted up, and I'm just like, get her away from me.
Do you still have that? At all? I mean, I don't have any sort of fear of clowns. I don't particularly like it. I hate mimes.
It's not fear. I find it a little eerie, and I think there, you know, there's plenty of psychology written on the idea, but this sort of opaque smile painted on.
That's what bothers
that,
you.
Well, I mean, it's almost the point of it, that it is meant to be this, like, perennial, joyful character. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you can't read that face. Like, if it's, you know, painted white with a smile, their actual intentions might not be apparent on their face. And so in this case, we have John Carroll Lynch playing Twisty the Clown, and his mouth is something else entirely.
Yeah.
His reveal that we'll talk about next episode is shocking. But in this, so we see him with a sort of plastic painted mouth of a mask. Yeah. So we get him from the nose up, and from below that, it's just the lower half of a mask.
Yeah.
And everything he's wearing, he's seemingly been wearing for years.
Yeah, he's filthy. He's disgusting. He, to me, was just one of the best images that Ryan Murphy really came up with.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was so unsettling. And I thought when I first started watching this season, I thought he was going to be the main part of the show. And I was almost disappointed that it wasn't the central character of the show, because I loved it so much. And John Carroll Lynch, you know, he's a man who can do a monologue like nobody's business. And you can feel so sorry for this man. It's outrageous.
Yeah, it's funny. On an earlier episode, you talked about, like, eye acting.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, he is acting his ass off with his eyes.
Yeah, and he just has this simpatico that you just go, oh, that's so sad. Everything about that particular man.
Yeah, with the exception of, like, his violent actions, which get pretty wild and gory. All right. So we've also got Lobster Boy, Jimmy Darling, played by Evan Peters, who's outstanding. And in this, he is a 1950s greaser kid, which I really liked.
In the very first episode, when we first meet him, there is a scene at a Tupperware party, and he is essentially hired to sexually pleasure these women, these housewives.
Yeah.
At this Tupperware party. And that was one thing that only happened in the first episode, and you never come back to that again. And I might have liked to just heard more about it, just because it's so, like, funny and weird and like such a bizarre thing.
They hadn't been in town that long, so that he is a man with a reputation enough to get this gig and to be welcomed into these women's homes is just like a little slice of what the fuck.
Yeah, when that scene unravels and you'd see why he's there, and you just, this is the strangest thing that I've seen.
He's essentially providing the service of, like, it might even be like turn of the century doctors who were quote unquote relieving women of their hysteria.
Exactly.
By manually masturbating them. Google it. It's as gross as it sounds. But so he is a rebel. He is a sex pot.
Yeah.
While he is a freak for having these sort of conjoined fingers.
Yes.
And I guess it is, there's a lineage to that.
There is. And even in this show, they talk about the genetics of it. It skips a generation. There was a real Lobster Boy, Grady Stiles Jr. He actually, his feet were also
bound.
It's just like deformed in that he could not walk at all.
Oh.
So he drug himself around on his arms and hands. So he was really, really strong. And this is important later on. He was a very violent man. Oh, he boy. Loved to drink, and he would beat, like, his wife, his daughter, anybody who could get in his little range wow. of motion. And he actually was so angry one time, he shot his daughter's husband, and he confessed, but he actually got released because they didn't have the equipment or the ability to keep him in the prison because okay. of his disability.
Yeah,
they weren't able to. So he just floor. Got away with it.
Wow.
Yeah. So he gets out like nothing ever happened. And I guess because he was able to confess to it and no punishment ever came of it, he became like wild with like this ego even more than previously.
Untouchable. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Continues to beat and be so very violent to his family. And in 1992, his family actually hires a guy and has him murdered.
First of all, he survived till 1992.
Yeah, 1992.
And that was the breaking point where I'm guessing he was like an old man. Yeah. They're just like, we've had enough of his shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty dramatic.
So, like, that's a crazy story. And I was, like, reading and going, this can't be true. And then I'd read some more and go, this is crazy. But it is. Grady Stiles Jr.
Kathy Bates is playing Ethel Darling, the yeah. bearded lady and mother of Lobster Boy. And those two are far more copacetic mm-hmm. Than Iris and Donovan in Hotel.
Yeah.
Like they're much more of a unit this mm-hmm. time around. And in this case, Evan Peters is a little bit, you know, Elsa is in charge. And we'll talk about Jessica Lange in a minute. But Jimmy is sort of like the man on the ground. He yeah. is of them, for them. And, you know, I liked his arc up top. And this episode ends on a particularly, like, rallying cry moment.
Don't we deserve to be happy?
Yeah!
When bad things keep happening to good people, you start to question what is right and what is wrong. Well, I say, it's time we make our own right and wrong. I say it's wrong for them to treat us like shit and kick us around like the scum of the earth. They want to call us monsters, fine. We'll act like monsters. From this day on, if anyone tries to mess with us, any of us, because you're one of us now, they're going to end up like this pig.
So Ethel is, I found her really endearing.
I think
her accent went a long
way.
That's
the thing. You cannot talk about this season of American Horror Story without talking about those accents. And especially...
You have a look like especially they bothered
Ethel.
You.
It did bother me because it was terrible.
Was it supposed to be Wisconsin? I had a hard time
pinning it
down.
No, it's supposed to
be... It's like Fargo-ish.
No, the O is definitely like that weird Baltimore O.
Ladies and gentlemen, direct... From the cabarets of pre-war Berlin, the enchantress who holds sway over all of nature's mistakes, Elsa Mars.
Oh, that, okay.
That's definitely the O sound, but then the rest of it didn't exactly make sense. And there was like this weird, like Scandinavian, Wisconsin, North Dakota kind of sounding thing.
To some of it, yeah.
And so you just found yourself the whole time being like, this doesn't make any sense. Nothing makes sense, but well, the O is all wrong for that. Seems clearly a Baltimore O.
In as much as she probably spent her life on the road, you know, like a sort like a military brat who's lived in a number of different states.
Well,
you could sort
I didn't
of see
hear
her
it.
Accent.
You know what it did the whole time? It just made me not want to listen to her.
Oh.
Yeah, it really bothers me. And watching it again irritates me further.
Take a look at the lawn man. Up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if he'll ever know. He's in the best-selling show.
So Jessica Lange is back, and sadly this was her last season. She's playing Elsa Mars, the yeah. German singer who is one of mystery. She's, you know, she's sort of made a very specific career choice that her traveling road show is not part of a bigger circus. They are
right.
their own autonomous unit. And you find out down the line that it kind of is that way so she can have the limelight.
Mm-hmm.
She is the ringmaster, although she's actually not doing a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of the showmanship. She's
no,
letting everybody
she comes
else
out and sings her songs.
Lead to her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there life on Mars?
The talk of freaks as commodities felt a little bit like a bigger statement was trying to be made about, say, actors in Hollywood and performers in general. And there is a sort of transition, even in Elsa's language, where she's sort of talking about her freaks, and she does start to refer to them as monsters. And I think she's not doing so with any malice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might even be a little bit of a nod to, say, like Lady Gaga, who comes into the sixth season or fifth season. And, you know, Lady Gaga refers to her fans as monsters,
right.
And it's never meant to be derogatory. It's just kind of like, we are different, we are together.
Yeah, we have imperfections, we're out of the norm.
Yeah, and Elsa, however, down the line, there's a little bit of contempt, like, building in her voice. Like, when they start sort of drawing the attention to themselves mm-hmm. as featured performers in this show, you can kind of feel that she doesn't like the direction things are going.
Right.
Late in the episode, Elsa has a really almost desperate confession about her need to draw in an audience.
But I have a confession to make. Those girls, I didn't bring them here for us. I brought them here for myself. So people would come.
And it happens, like, moments after she smokes some opium, so you kind of feel like in vino veritas.
Yeah.
Except whatever the opium equivalent of that is. But she, I mean, it's almost overly confessional, where it feels like exposition for the show.
Mm-hmm.
But it does kind of add to this push and pull element where she is in charge. She, you know, thinks of them as a family, but really, who's benefiting? Also in the cast is a familiar face if you were seeing the series in continuity, but Pepper, who appears in season 2 in
Who I love Asylum. From Asylum.
Yeah. And so Pepper is played by Naomi Grossman in, like, perhaps the most humbling portrayal of a character I can think of.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Naomi Grossman is a, you know, sort of, I'm going to use the word, standard actress in terms
she's
of
very
like
beautiful.
Full faculties. And so that she is fully willing to, like, shave her head and, you know, apply the nose, and her body language is perfect.
Yeah, no, she's great. She's like an unsung hero of this season.
So she's part of a duo with Christopher Neiman, who plays Salty mm-hmm. and Pepper. Get it?
Get it.
But they are very specifically based on other quote-unquote pinheads in terms of their faculty. And so Pepper is vocal, mm-hmm. and she, you know, like I said, she is given certain tasks on the show. Whereas Salty is nonverbal, really.
Right.
And so I saw direct corollaries to the movie Freaks.
Yeah, and in Freaks, you have the Snow Sisters playing Pip and Zip.
Okay.
And then you have Schlitzie. And that's how Freaks actually opens, is with the three of them kind of seeing how happy they are and how joyful they are. And people love them because people loved to go see them in particular just because they were so innocent and childlike.
Mm.
And it was really nice. And so in American Horror Story, you have this really sweet relationship between Pepper, and she's married to Salty. And it is a very sweet, sad relationship.
Yeah. So obviously we're leaving out a number of characters, but mm-hmm. that's because they don't appear in this first episode of the season. They come into play. So like Angela Bassett's coming in.
Right.
The commish, Michael Chiklis.
Right. Comes Finn
in
Wittrock
later.
Just shows up too.
Finn Wittrock. Well, I guess he's in the first episode, and we are introduced to like the spoiled rich kid dynamic where it goes to the worst place imaginable.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk about that because to me, He's really great in this. And I know you disagree.
I the second viewing, I've come around.
Yeah, I think he's great.
So that'll wrap it up for this episode. We've got a lot more coming. The next episode, we'll talk about this sort of episode breakdowns without spoilers. And that'll do it for now. So join us on social media, where we have a regular back and forth with the fans. That's a lot of fun. It's, you know, it's almost a regular GIF party.
Yeah, exactly. Or lots
GIF
of
party,
GIFs.
Depending on which, you know, what
on
year.
On which one of us you're talking
you grew
to.
Up in. our website is therantsmacabre.com. Also, our email is therantsmacabre lunchhourreviews@gmail.com. Drop us a line. Give us some show suggestions. We're always looking for new stuff to watch or read.
And if you like what you're hearing and you want to pay for some more and hear extra stuff that we don't do for free, then come see us at patreon.com/rantsmacabre.
You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment, and edited by Mindy. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at Fangoria.com. This is me, Darren, signing off.
And I'm Mindy. Thanks.